want to welcome you for our session. This is Stephanie Bachmann-Mattei. So a few words about myself. I am a certified trainer with the Center for Nonviolent Communication. Had the blessing to meet Dr. Marshall Rosenberg and Inbal Kasdan, who is a certified trainer who focused on parenting. Same year, my second son was a year old when I met them, and both of them really had a tremendous impact on my life. For me, encountering NVC was really the next tool after having learned about attachment and responding to baby's cues and all of that. So having this new tool around how to maintain the connection with my children while they were growing up. So I had, as I said, my second son was 1 year old, so my first one was 4. And so it was really an incredible blessing for myself and my whole family to encounter NVC. So it's always, you know, a sheer pleasure for me to be able to share a little bit of my journey. I just, you know, wanting to play a little bit with all of you. I noticed one of the emails of the NVC Academy, it was saying, you know, 12 experts. And I giggled because I don't consider myself an expert. I am a person, you know, on the way, on a path to, what is my path? It's to learn, to rediscover how to love unconditionally. And so whether it's the relationship with myself, with my children, with my partner, with anyone, really, that is my journey. And I enjoy sharing some of the things that have been helpful on my path with other people, other parents, with the hope that it may be of support to them as well. So I usually enjoy starting a session with a self-connection practice. So if you are willing, just take a few minutes to really land, you know, give ourselves the opportunity to fully land to this call and make ourselves fully present. We might have transitioned from one thing to another, so maybe a moment to really settle down and being able to fully land can be helpful to all of us. So if you are willing to just take a comfortable sitting position, I'm assuming you are sitting, maybe you're lying, whatever your position is, just to check in with your body and make sure that it's as comfortable as possible. And at the same time that it supports alertness. So I like to keep my spine straight as if I had a little thread coming from the center of my head and slightly pulling the knees at the same height as the hips and the feet firmly placed on the floor so that I can really feel the carpet or floor underneath my feet. Then if you feel comfortable, close your eyes or lower your gaze. Bring your attention to the natural flow of your breath. There is nothing to change, nowhere to arrive. Just be with your breath as it naturally happens. In breath, the out breath. You will notice that as soon as you want to focus on your breath, maybe after the first breath or after a handful, your mind will start wandering. So you may find yourself thinking about things that have happened or things that you would like to attend to after the call. Whenever you notice that your mind is somewhere else, grateful to yourself because this is a moment of awakening. And gently bring your mind back. I like to take this image, you know, like when we are training a little puppy who is very lively. We gently and, you know, playfully redirect the puppy. So redirecting the mind to the flow of the breath. Then check again with your body. Any sensations you are aware of. Again, nothing to be changed. So if you notice some tension, some restlessness, just notice it. Then ask yourself, what am I feeling right in this moment? Once you have identified your emotional landscape, try to breathe into it. So you're not doing a laundry list. You are actually really connecting your heart, your emotions. Once you have identified and really taken in what's alive for you right now in this very moment in terms of feelings, then ask yourself, what is this feeling pointing to? What is or are the needs that are really alive for me in this very moment? Maybe it's something related to your well-being, physical, emotional, mental. Maybe it's something about connection. Or self-expression. Clarity of mind, freedom. So whatever the need is that you are connecting to, just really take it in, your breath. Then with your imagination, place this need, the chest of your own heart. Knowing that this is life manifesting in you, going through you. Then slowly reconnect with your body, your breath. Whenever you feel ready, open your eyes. If you close them, become aware of the environment you're sitting in and our circle. I would like to share a poem. It's a poem written by Mary Oliver. It is called Wild Geese. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert, repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting over and over, announcing your place in the family of things. And I would like to hear if anyone is moved, how that is landing with you, anything stirring up hearing those words. So if you're willing, I would like to hear from one or two people.
I think we feel as humans like our despair separates us, like our pain, other people don't have pain or shame, and our despair separates us. But this poem made me immediately feel connected with others in my despair. It was wonderful. And in my joy with all the other pieces of the poem. Thank you.
Yes, you are touching a very important point, and that is that, you know, when we are in pain, so when we have intense emotions and maybe, you know, we behaved in, especially when we behaved in ways that we later regret, you know, one of the things that can easily happen in our brain is a sense of isolation. So we go down this spiral of, you know, there is something wrong with me, why did I mess up, and all of that. And yes, we forget that we are part of the human family. And as Mary reminds us, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things. So this is, you know, for me, it's what Kathleen was sharing the other day about the non-negotiable self-worth. So regardless of my behavior, of what, you know, I consider my mistakes, I have a place in the family of things. So thank you for highlighting that aspect. Today, I would like to share a little bit of my own journey with my own reactivity and some of the things that have helped me. That has been part of my journey, you know, just facing, you know, my thoughts about something being wrong with me, what a bad mother I am, what's wrong with me, you know, I'm on this NBC path and I'm not able to integrate stuff, I mess up with my children. And so this sense of isolation, that I am different from others. And so I hope that, you know, through this session, there might be some things that maybe resonate for you and that you can take away and play with it. Really, when I started looking at my own reactivity, I could see that there were moments of reoccurring events, reoccurring emotions that I could face and I would face. And so I started, you know, looking what is underneath. So it's like, you know, I just see the very point of an iceberg, so my behavior, but what is underneath? One question that has been very helpful for me on my own journey was, what is taking me out of relationship? So I would notice that, you know, in this is a parenting class, so I will refer mostly to my relationship with my kids, but really it is applicable to any relation. So what is taking me out of relation when things get rough, when the going gets rough? And I came across two words that really explained a whole lot to me and helped me really shift my thinking a whole lot. You know that in NBC, one of the principles is to move away from the right and wrong mentality. And that is a very difficult thing for me to do. It has been, it still is quite challenging. And I hear from, you know, the people I work with, co-trainers, that this is really a big piece. And so these two words have been from the field of brain science, and those two words are regulation and dysregulation. So regulation is basically, you know, when my brain is able to cope with the stress that I am facing. So maybe, you know, we are getting up late, my daughter doesn't want to brush her teeth on her own, my son doesn't find his backpack, and in the midst of all of that, I am still able to stay present to myself and to my children. So I can prioritize connection, I can remember my values, I can remember my skills, and everything is okay. So there is stress, but it is not overwhelming. But then something happens. Maybe somebody spills the milk. And that then leads my brain to a state of dysregulation. That means that, you know, the stress that I am experiencing is beyond my ability to cope with. So for those of you who were on the call with Eric, you know, he was referring to Dr. Siegel's saying of flipping the lid. So that is basically when my brain enters a state of dysregulation. And so I lose connection, my brain loses connection with certain parts of the prefrontal cortex that are the higher functioning abilities of my brain. And so I do not have access to all of my inner resources. And the way that I learned about regulation and dysregulation was through this image of the window of stress tolerance. And on the slide, you have simply a child A, a child B, simply because, you know, I often work also with adoptive parents. I am an adoptive parent myself. Two of my children are biological, and one joined the family through adoption. And so children, you know, who join families through adoption come with a particular difficult baggage. And just simply the separation from the biological mother, even if it happens at birth. But regardless of whether you look at it as a child A, a child B, or, you know, just ourselves, we basically all have some trauma stored because of some things that happened most of the time during childhood or adolescence. And so then we have, you know, a certain amount of space for really being able to cope with stress. So this is the emotional space for stress. And then there is a breaking point. That is when my brain goes into a state of dysregulation. And if I apply that to myself, you know, I can say that depending on where I am in my life, maybe I have a move in front of me, or I just moved, or there is a new baby. So even events that are joyful can produce stress. And so I can be aware of my own window of stress tolerance and just notice that there is less space before I reach my breaking point. Maybe I had sleepless nights. Maybe I have some big events and I'm a little anxious about that. And so that is also for our children. And I actually have taught to my children and countless children I have been working with and families about this window of stress tolerance with the image of a glass. With some milk in it, and so how much space is there where I can still pour milk, and where do I need to stop before it pours out? And so the stopping is really becoming aware of my stress level and do something about it before I go into a state of dysregulation. And so that explains a lot to me in terms of brain states and mind states. So we can really simply imagine the brain, you know, having these two options of being in a state of regulation and dysregulation. And behavior is a communication of that brain state. So if I am losing it and the going gets rough and I have a lot of intensity, that is telling me I'm either reaching the point of dysregulation or just, you know, already hit it. And so it's also for my children. So I can, by monitoring my own behavior or my children's behavior, and in my case, my own inner cues, body sensations, I can actually gauge where am I with my stress tolerance level. But so one of the pieces that also helped me in understanding myself more by looking at my intensity and my reactivity was this question. Do I tend to get angry or do I tend to shut down emotionally to my children when the going gets rough? And that is because the brain, you know, again, when it goes into a state of dysregulation, it has two options. It either goes into hyperarousal or hypoarousal. And here I'm referring specifically to Dr. Bruce Perry, with whom I have studied, and I highly recommend his books. Basically, the brain can go into a fight or flight. And I am purposely not quoting the freeze because that is part of a different continuum. The freeze reaction is part of the dissociation continuum. And the hyper and hypo arousal is part of the arousal continuum. So in that continuum, we basically have these two options. So do I get angry? So do I fight? My brain explodes. Or do I shut down emotionally? So I go into a flight. I withdraw from the situation and I am not available anymore emotionally to my children. Depending on the relationship, the situations, it can differ, and at the same time, we have kind of a default system. So I would like for you to take a moment and spend a few minutes jotting down whatever comes to mind to you in regards to this question. And I will not ask you to share. That is just for your own work. So if you are willing to just sit with this question, do I tend to get angry or do I tend to shut down emotionally? As I said, it's a continuum. Some people are explosive, some people withdraw, but it's part of the same reactivity of the brain due to overwhelming stress.
I tend to find that I do both of these things. Is that not common? First I fight, and then after I get all my anger out, I tell them I can't talk to you right now. And I take a couple of hours.
I appreciate the self-awareness. For me, at this point, you know, the question is really in the moment where the going gets rough. So when, you know, my needs are not met, the situation is stressful, I can't cope with it somehow. What is my first reaction? Is it fighting or fleeing? So I'm hearing that your first reaction is of anger.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. All right. So I will give you just 2-3 minutes to sit with this question and let you work on your own. It's just for your own work. I will not ask you to share. I'm imagining that some of you might have enjoyed more time to actually explore that, and I would like to invite you to just revisit that question at another time. For me, it has been very enlightening in terms of just noticing my inner dynamics and how I react and what happens to the relationship. I want to check in if anyone does want a mic to either ask a clarifying question or feels moved to share.
I was just thinking about, especially when you added the second part, what does that do to the relationship? So my natural tendency when I get angry or overloaded is to withdraw because I don't feel capable of expressing myself, especially in the past. And what that does to the relationship is then whoever it is I'm interacting with also withdraws because they don't know how to respond to me. And then my need is connection, and I become overwhelmed because what I really want is not anger but connection, and I don't know how to express that. So I see that that's been a reoccurring pattern all through my life, even from childhood, a lot of miscommunication about needs. That was very enlightening. Thank you.
Thank you. And I celebrate the self-awareness because, for me, this is the most important piece. Unless we are aware of what's going on within us and interpersonally, I don't see how growth can happen. But when we become aware and we can bring acceptance as a second step. So the first one is awareness, acknowledgement, but then also acceptance. And I will talk about that later on in the call. Those for me are really components that can support us on our journey. See another hand. You have a mic.
I was noticing as I thought back that when I was younger, as a child and, you know, most of my life, certainly in school, my automatic reaction was intensity, but I didn't feel safe to express it. There was no space for that. I didn't want to get in trouble. So I would keep it inside. So it was, in a sense, almost like withdrawing outwardly, but inwardly I was just all fired up and taking it inward. I guess they call that implosion. But I thought, wow, you know, that was very helpful to have that time there. Thank you for that. Kind of explore that pattern of, you know, having all this intensity but not doing anything with it, really. Thanks.
Yeah, depending on our experiences, especially as children, you know, I bet in most families, you know, we grew up with a sense that not all of our emotions were welcomed. I have a sense, you know, in my own family, it wasn't only, you know, big emotions in the sense of, you know, like anger, but even, you know, big vitality was not totally welcomed. Just noticing, it's not to blame anyone or point fingers. It's really to bring some understanding of what is happening in us and opening up to possibilities by seeing how things are working right now. So going back to stress, stress is huge, and we talk a lot about it, especially in, you know, recent years. There has been a lot of research on the implications of stress on the body, on the mind, behaviorally, emotionally. A couple of things that I want to mention. Stress increases what are considered, you know, I know in NBC we talk about all emotions are energy in motion, so we do not want to make them positive or negative, but rather, you know, uncomfortable emotions, let's call them this way, like frustration, anger, all these intense emotions that bring up some kind of pain or discomfort. And the other piece is an increased sense of self. So when I'm stressed, I take things very personally. And that is basically how the brain works, because it goes into this state of self-protection and everything becomes about me. And so if I'm also able to recognize that, then maybe I can then remind myself that maybe it's not really about me. But initially, that is how the brain works. It goes into a self-protective mode. It is in dysregulation. And so everything becomes about my own survival. And so I am at the center of everything. And everybody else kind of fades in the distance or in the background. So naturally, I will take things very personally. Some of the things that happen with stress are we go into the past or we project into the future. And you might have noticed this tendency, which is a normal tendency of the mind, even in our short meditation. We want to focus on the breath, and then we think about the spaghetti I just ate, or, you know, the email that I need to send after the class. So my mind goes into the future or goes back into the past, and it is not in the present moment. And that is increased the more stress I have and the more my brain gets dysregulated, the less I will be present in the present moment. I also lose a whole lot of IQ points, again, because certain part of my prefrontal cortex gets disconnected. And so I do not have access to those parts. And so my thinking becomes confused and distorted. If you are parents, it has happened 1,000 times with myself. My child did something. I can see that he is in a state of dysregulation from the behavior. You know, I can see maybe, you know, my daughter is throwing some blocks. Didn't I tell you 1,000 times not to throw blocks? This is something that all parents say. Didn't I tell you, you know, 1,000 times? And yet the brain does not have access to that information when it is in a state of dysregulation. So my daughter will not remember that I told her 1,000 times. And so my brain does not remember certain skills of NVC when it is in a state of dysregulation. Another thing that happens when the brain goes into a state of dysregulation is that we regress. There is this saying, when we stress, we regress. And we usually regress at, you know, an age level, an emotional level where our needs for comfort and safety were not met. So, again, this is another question that I've asked myself. You know, when I see myself behaving in ways that I can tell are kind of not really regulated, I ask myself, what is my age right now? Not in a blameful or, you know, sarcastic way, but really with a gentle inquiry. Maybe, you know, I'm just behaving like a 2-year-old, or maybe I'm behaving like a 14-year-old. And again, that also happens for our children. So the more trauma there is, the more regression there is. But also for any child, when they are in a state of dysregulation, they go back. So we have in a chronological age, so my son may be 12, but, you know, when he's overwhelmed, his emotional age may be, I don't know, an 8-year-old. And maybe his cognitive age, you know, is even beyond 12. But right now, since we are talking about dysregulation, it's the emotional age that is really important. And so I want to address that when I'm dealing with my children in a state of dysregulation. I want to address that age. So I will not go to my 12-year-old and say, you know better, but I will really just empathize with him, really seeing him at a younger age than he is chronologically. Other aspects of how dysregulation can manifest. It obviously brings impulsive behavior, a lot of self-judgment, difficulty in thinking and problem-solving because we have less access to the prefrontal cortex and the higher functioning of the brain. All kinds of fears. So I can see that very much in my adopted daughter, but when she is in a state of dysregulation, she has, you know, stronger fears. And I can see that in myself as well, and I wasn't adopted. Again, that is something that we can notice if there is some deep fear in myself or in my child that can be also a signal that the brain is in a state of dysregulation. So the crucial piece about this regulation and dysregulation is really that when we are in a state of dysregulation, there is no ability to be in relationship. And so we cannot really be present for our children. We cannot give them the safety, and we cannot respond to their needs to be seen and soothed and feeling secure that they so need to develop a healthy attachment. So it boils down to, if I'm not happy, nobody is happy, because I am not present to my children and I cannot give them what they need. So what can we do about it? I have some tools that I would like to share with you. One very, very important piece that I have learned is that by learning how to regulate our attention, so how to know where to focus my attention, regulates my emotions. If I'm able to regulate my attention, I can regulate my emotions. And that is part of the reason why I shared at the beginning the self-connection practice. So the more I can be aware of where I am in my window of stress tolerance and bring myself back by focusing my attention on something other than my thinking can be very, very helpful and can really make a huge difference between losing it and regaining some groundedness. So the breath. The breath is always available. And it is something that we can easily connect to and bring our attention to. It just takes one breath, one conscious breath, to bring ourselves back in contact with ourselves, and three breaths to maintain the contact. I would just like to invite all of us, just take a moment and just take three breaths. Be aware of how the air comes in and goes out. Now, in order to remember to breathe when we are entering or are already in a state of dysregulation, it is important to train the mind by practicing repeatedly so that we can really create new neuropaths. I highly suggest 5 minutes, once or twice a day, beginning of the day, end of the day, of breath awareness, something like we did in the beginning, or some other kind of self-connection practice, so that you are helping your brain to learn those states of regulation so you can find your way back when you enter or are in a state of dysregulation. Otherwise, it's too difficult. It's like going to the gym and wanting to lift, I don't know, 20 pounds, and I never lifted anything. No, I start with 5, and I slowly, slowly increase. And so it's with our brain. We train our brain. So the breath actually settles down the fight or flight response. I just asked you to go with the flow of your natural breath. But if you double the exhalation in relation to the inhalation, so the inhalation is 4, the exhalation is 8, for example, that will settle down the fight or flight stress response even more, because it actually helped the parasympathetic nervous system kick in, which is like the brake of the brain. And so it soothes the sympathetic nervous system, which is the accelerator of the brain. Breath awareness also changes brain waves. There are many studies that show that with mindful breathing, we go from beta, awake, normal, alert state, to alpha, relaxed, calm, and lucid waves. I can't emphasize enough how important the breath is in terms of bringing us back to a state of regulation. It takes just a few breaths, and it can already, you know, make a huge difference in terms of soothing the amygdala, the part of the brain that gets triggered and initiates the whole fight-flight response.
You mentioned that the breath is the easiest and most effortless way to connect with ourselves or calm ourselves. Breath is always available. That's not true for some people I know. I have a friend who has very severe asthma, chronic asthma. So we've discussed different ways of doing self-connection that don't involve focusing on the breath. And I wondered if you had others' ideas to offer, or if you opened to ideas.
Yeah, I really appreciate you bringing up this point. And it's actually a lead way to the second practice that I wanted to share, which is body awareness. So if the breath doesn't work, And sometimes for certain people it doesn't. For other people, especially if there has been abuse, the body doesn't work. So it's good to have several tools. Breath awareness is one tool. I would like now to share another tool, which is body attunement. And I also want to mention, we'll not practice that here, sound awareness or just sight. So working with any of our senses can support us. So if I'm seeing myself going into a state of dysregulation or am in dysregulation, you know, noticing the birds singing, or it could be the water dripping or whatever sounds I have available. It could be the cars passing on the road. But you focus your attention to a sound, or it could be on your environment, something you see. But just the fact of focusing your attention to something other than the thoughts that fuel that dysregulation can be very supportive in regulating the emotions. Does that satisfy you for right now?
Yes, that's very helpful. Thank you.
And so, not seeing any other hands, I would actually like to invite you all for another practice that I have found extremely helpful. And I know that it has been introduced in several prisons, people who bring mindfulness in prisons. And that is what I call a mindfulness intensity practice. So if you are willing to just stand or sit with your feet flat on the floor so that you can really sense the feet on the floor, and just take a few breaths, natural flow of your breath. And then think of something that leads to feelings of anger in you. So it could be something that happened today or yesterday. And the more you think about it, it builds up anger. When you sense that, you know, you are kind of winding up or are already wind up, then shift your focus to your feet. Just become aware of your feet. And maybe become aware of the touch points of your feet with the floor. Or any sensations around your feet. Maybe some heat, some numbness, some tingling, whatever that is. Just bring your awareness to your feet. Stay there until you feel your body starting to relax. So this is also a very quick practice, but it becomes more and more powerful the more you practice with it. So again, if you once a day, once every couple of days, whatever you want to commit to, if you are willing, if you want to give it a try, you know, play with it. So increase the intensity of your anger and then drop your attention to your feet and see what happens.
My question was, on the slide that showed dysregulation and you had the branches of a lot of different things, compulsive behavior, low self-esteem, in terms of the model that we're working with, when you're in dysregulation, these things are all occurring, and now you're taking one of these techniques and using it, sensing the sights and the sounds or being mindful, and you're now, let's say you're in the prefrontal cortex and you're regulating. You're saying it's a practice to develop these brain states that if you're highly dysregulated, then there are certain patterns in the brain and you have to slowly change these patterns out of dysregulation, or once you're in the I don't know how it works schematically, this emotional regulation.
Thank you for the question. For me, there is a state of dysregulation which I enter because the stress level in the moment right now is beyond my ability to cope with it. And so maybe I start yelling to my kids or I withdraw or, you know, there is intense reactivity in me. So that is in the moment. And those practices can help us soothe our brain and reconnect with those parts of the prefrontal cortex and so regain regulation. And then there is a more overarching state of my brain. So maybe if I am prone to, you know, depression or anxiety, my brain is basically in a state of continuous chronic dysregulation. So those practices taken very, very seriously and practiced on a daily basis, it has been proven those practices not only shift the mind states, but changes the very structure of the brain. I don't know if you heard about Dr. Kabat-Zinn. He is a medical doctor, and he brought, like 30 years ago, mindfulness practices into the medical field. He developed an 8-week mindfulness stress reduction practice. So it is helpful in the moment, and those practices can also really dramatically shift the overarching state of our brain and shift the very structure, not only the function. Is this answering your question?
It does, to some extent. Is dysregulation somewhat synonymous with trauma then? For instance, if I have a perpetual fear of abandonment that maybe comes from some memory that wasn't stored properly, so as we've learned, it's always floating around there, I might label that trauma, but it could also be labeled dysregulation.
Dysregulation, in my understanding, is the state of the brain due to the trauma. We have stored some trauma, and then we have some space for stress. So the more trauma there is, the less space for additional stress there is. And so my brain more easily tips into dysregulation continuously.
That answered my question. Thank you.
Thank you for sticking with it until it was satisfying for you. I would like to share a little paragraph by Rainer Maria Rilke, who is a German poet. And he says, "I would like to beg you, dear sir, as well as I can, to have patience with everything unresolved in your heart, and to try to love the questions themselves as if they were locked rooms or books written in a very foreign language. Don't search for the answers which could not be given to you now, because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps then someday, far in the future, you will gradually, without even noticing it, live your way into the answer." That is my invitation to you, because much of our reoccurring reactivity stems from things that are not integrated. I would just like to refer you, if you are interested in parenting and self-understanding, Dr. Siegel's book, Parenting from the Inside Out. When we are faced with reoccurring triggers and reoccurring reactivity, that basically can tell us that something needs attention in us. So I am reacting from something that is stored, most probably not so consciously, and I'm not even aware of it. So the more I can bring awareness, the more understanding I can bring to it, the more I integrate my life story, the more I increase the capacity to be present to my children and can support them in their attachment. And for me, one piece was, you know, what is the recurring reactivity? For me, it was really looking at when my reaction was somehow mismatched to what had happened. That would be like a little alarm bell telling me, okay, there seems to be a mismatch here on my intensity with what just happened. So maybe there is something that needs attention in me. And that would be the first signal for me. And so I'm offering you several questions in some of the slides just for you, if you are willing, you know, to play with them and let the answers come when they show up, so you can start connecting some dots around creating more self-understanding. I would like to offer a couple of other practices for you to take away. You know, specifically practices around self-acceptance and self-compassion. Because as we touched at the beginning, stress brings us into fight or flight. And if any of those are viable responses, then we go into a freeze reaction. And one way of seeing fight and flight is the self-criticism, which is one of the effects of dysregulation. We criticize ourselves, so it's an internal fight. We flight, and so the self-isolation we were talking about in the beginning, and we become self-absorbed, you know, the self-referencing, so I take everything personally, which can be considered kind of a freeze. So I freeze into it's all about me. So how to get out of those three states of self-criticism, self-isolation, and self-absorption? It's really a path of self-compassion. It's a path of accepting ourselves while we are experiencing pain. And it's because we are suffering that I want to extend some support and some care to myself so that I can accept myself, I can accept the pain I'm in, and I can even accept the reaction around the pain. And those are two practices that I learned by my teachers, Christine Neff and Christopher Germer, with whom I have studied some. And they have actually taken the 8-week stress reduction, Kabat-Zinn's, and really focused on the self-compassion. The first one is self-acceptance break. So again, think of something that brings up pain and intensity in you. Bring your hands on your chest, on your heart, and acknowledge to yourself, this is a difficult moment. May I accept this circumstance in my life? May I accept myself just as I am? Really, you can play with the words, but it's really about, again, like pausing from the influence of the trigger, so what is happening inside, and the external reaction. So acknowledging that this is a difficult moment and that suffering is part of life. May I be gentle with myself? And you can play with the words, but it's really about pausing. This is a difficult moment. Realizing that suffering is part of life. So it's, again, we are connected. I'm not alone. I'm not the only one suffering. And then one intention, may I be gentle with myself? And the other one, which I consider like a daily self-compassion check-in, is am I loving myself right now? Or what is the most compassionate thing I can do for myself right now? And so really taking a habit of checking our window of stress tolerance and asking ourselves, what can we do?
Could you repeat? There were a couple of self-compassion things that you said.
Basically, you know, the idea is first to pause. So this is a moment of suffering, or this is a difficult moment. Out, that is painful, you know, whatever the wording. It's really becoming aware in the moment of the suffering and then acknowledging that the suffering is part of life. So there is nothing wrong with me. You know, I'm not the only one suffering or, you know, experiencing some roughness. And then an intention. May I be gentle with myself? May I accept myself? Something like that. I would like, again, to make space for questions and comments. And also, I would love to hear from at least a few of you anything that you are taking away of this time together, or if there are any unmet needs, to please let me know for my own learning and growth.
Yes, I want to thank you so much for giving me this tool to practice self-awareness and compassion. Because I feel like I finally have something tangible that I can use in heated moments with my daughter. I was searching for something tangible that somebody could tell me what to do when words just don't work. And going away does not work. And, you know, nothing works like that. And I feel like finally I have an answer. Finally I have something I can use. And I just so appreciate this. It's a gift. Thank you so much.
I'm really moved hearing your words. What you just shared is a gift to me. Anyone else?
I just wanted to thank you for the tools. They're very useful, you know, very easy to understand. And, you know, with a little practice, I'm sure I can benefit from them enormously. So thank you so much for giving us so many tools.
Thank you. I enjoy the feedback. I just want to share one last thing. I am so passionate about, you know, all that I shared. I have seen what a huge difference it makes in my life. You know, my website is available under my bio. It's www.thesanctuary4parents. And there also you can find some resources. It is my pleasure to be of support and to walk this path of parenting and self-regulation.